Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, January 16, 2018. The spokesman of the SPLM former detainees says First Vice President Taban Dengai is violating the ceasefire agreement.
Even if he's not fighting, that is a violation. Moving troops without following the procedures laid down in the cessation of hostilities.
And South Sudanese students are stuck in Zimbabwe.
I'm not really happy because it still affects the future, my future. Like, even passing, you even find it difficult to concentrate. It's really challenging. It's really not good.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The South Sudan ceasefire agreement signed at the end of December is at risk of collapsing as the warring parties continue to thread accusations of violations. The spokesman for the former SPLM detainees, Kosti Manibe, is accusing South Sudan's first Vice President, Taban Dengai, of violating the terms of the deal. Kosti says Guy is touring several areas in Jonglei and Upper Nile states with huge number of soldiers who are well armed.
The Vice President, Taban Dengai, moving from Juba with a large contingent of soldiers into Jonglei. That type of movement, as per the cessation of hostilities agreement, is a violation. That is why we specifically mentioned it. We also are aware that even if he's not fighting, that is a violation. Moving troops without following the procedures laid down in the cessation of hostilities.
Is there any report by JMAC or CITISAM about this specific violation that you're talking about?
I have not seen any report, but of course people have talked about it. That there are complaints about it that have been loudly spoken about. But we don't even need to refer to that. It is the government's own admission saying that Taban is going there to visit his constituent. And he has been seen there by many groups.
This is happening at a time when the government spokesperson, who is also the Minister of Information, who was talking to us saying the government is not violating the ceasefire. It is the other group violating the ceasefire. And here you are saying that the movement of the first vice president with a lot of troops is clearly a violation of the ceasefire deal. Who is to hold them accountable? Because they can say they are a government, they have the freedom to move wherever they want to.
There is no freedom to move. There is a terms of the cessation of hostilities. Unless the government spokesman does not know, has not read it or doesn't know what violation amounts to, which is spelled out in the cessation of hostilities. So obviously, that type of movement of troops is a violation by itself, even if they were not going to have military engagement. The simple fact of moving troops and equipment contrary to the terms of the cessation of hostilities is a violation.
I was also reading a report by CITISAM dated the 5th of January. They were talking about a lot of fighting in your home area, that is in former Western Equatoria. There's been a lot of fighting there. Can you tell us more about what you hear from home?
Well, what I hear from home is that since before signing the cessation of hostilities agreement, there have been increased fighting there. And it has continued. It's never stopped. Even as of now, there is still fighting going on.
Between who and who? Who is fighting who? Who is fighting who?
I believe, of course, between the government forces and the forces there who ally themselves and call themselves IO forces. So it is between government and IO.
We were together in Addis last month, and you heard the statements from Troika, from the IGAD Council of Ministers, and there were no kind words for the warring parties. In the backdrop of what you're telling me now, is IGAD doing something about these violations?
I think it is a matter of public records that the Ethiopian Minister of Foreign Affairs on behalf of IGAD did issue a public statement condemning the...
I know that the SPLM leaders, popularly known as former detainees, chose not to carry arms and fight the government in Juba, but to engage the government and engage the international community in a continuous dialogue in a bid to find a solution to this conflict. If the former detainees are given an opportunity to speak to the international community at this moment, what would you tell them?
Well, I will tell them that unless they are able to stand by their word and ensure that some form of consequences are visited on those who violate the secession of hostilities agreement, then it does not end well for the peace process at all.
That's Kosti Manibe, the spokesman for the former SPLM detainees. He was speaking to me yesterday from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Classes at Harare Institute of Technology are set to begin next month, but South Sudanese students studying at the institute on scholarship say they don't know if they will be able to attend classes. Ayen Bior has details from Washington.
February 7th will be the first day of classes at Harare Institute of Technology. South Sudanese scholarship students say they should be enjoying their vacation and resting up for another semester of classes. But instead, they are left wondering what their fate will be.
As you can hear my tone, I'm not really happy because it really affects the future, my future. Like, because for you to come and spend almost 3 years, then you study under this kind of situation, even passing, you even find it difficult to concentrate. It's really challenging. It's really not good.
That is Ganiko Michael Bangoye, a 22-year-old third-year student studying electronic commerce and one of the 26 South Sudanese students studying in Harare, whose scholarships are supposed to be paid by the government. To make matters worse, he and other South Sudanese students say they have heard rumors that the government is planning to recall the students, aside from those preparing to graduate in September. They say their hope is running thin.
We are hoping that maybe during these holidays, the government will be able to do something, but unfortunately, things are not working. We are just here. We don't know what may happen. Either we will be taken back. So that's just the scenario. But it's actually not good as for now, because we are here. We are struggling. I know student life is not easy, but it's just too much now.
The students blame their government in Juba for not paying hundreds of thousands of dollars in unpaid tuition. Paiti Solomon, a third-year student in food processing technology, thought the issue had been resolved months ago.
When we went to the embassy, they sent $500,000. That was, you know, paid as part of the debt that they were owing the school. But they didn't pay all of the money. And they gave the university's promises that they will pay the coming month. That was August.
In April last year, the government reached an agreement with the school to pay part of the tuition owed, about $240,000, with a promise to deliver on the rest. The students, many of them who were camped out in the embassy at the time, thought everything had returned to normal.
Yeah, we sat for exams in November to December, but up to now we haven't seen the results due to the unpaid tuition that the government is owing the school.
The unpaid balance not only prohibits students from accessing last semester's final exam grades, but some of them say the government was also responsible for buying their food during the holiday. While the school has continued to provide accommodations, the students say they have struggled to find food. Ayan Bior for VOA News, Washington.
South Africa's two top political parties began the year by pledging to restore credibility amid corruption allegations against key leaders. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg that as next year's election draw closer, South Africa's political players are driving home the message that corruption is their main target.
The ruling African National Congress and embattled President Jacob Zuma have long been accused of corruption. Critics of the government say this has left the state unable to carry out basic duties. But Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa, who succeeded Zuma as the ANC's top leader last month, says that will change. Here he is in the coastal city of East London over the weekend, taking several not-so-subtle jabs at Zuma, who was accused of siphoning off tens of millions of dollars and of letting a wealthy Indian family have undue influence over the government.
These challenges have been exacerbated by state capture through which billions of rands have been illegally diverted to individuals, corruption in state-owned enterprises and other public institutions have undermined our government's programs to address poverty and unemployment, and they have weakened those institutions.
The ANC has dominated national politics for a quarter century, but has lost ground in recent years to the opposition Democratic Alliance, which captured three major cities in 2016's municipal polls. Meanwhile, the DA is having its own reckoning, charging Cape Town Mayor Patricia de Lille with corruption under the party's own disciplinary process. De Lille reported to work Monday, but her party relegated many key responsibilities, like the city's dire water crisis, to other officials. In Johannesburg, the city's mayor said Monday he was firing a top city finance official amid allegations of nepotism and undue influence. Party leader Musi Maimane spoke to reporters Sunday in Cape Town.
The true test of any political party is what it does when confronted with serious allegations of political dysfunction, maladministration, and governance failures. The DA, unlike many of our political competitors, stands largely alone in acting with resolve in confronting such issues, even when those decisions, in fact, come at a very serious political cost.
Political analyst Ralph Matega says these events may indicate that the two parties, which often try to cast themselves as each other's antithesis, may not be so different after all. He says he believes both leaders' words are sincere, but notes that they both face challenges in bringing their own parties into line.
The challenges that the DA is facing are not so different from that of the ANC. And actually, if you look at the allegations of corruption within the DA in the city of Johannesburg, you have the MMC of Finance being suspended, and you have de Lille as well, allegations coming out against her regarding impropriety. What that shows is that the DA is also battling with corruption within its ranks, and also the problem seems to be emerging regarding the integrity of internal processes in dealing with this.
But he says one thing is clear. South Africa's parties need to scrub themselves thoroughly within before they can show their shiny new faces to voters next year. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the alarming number of traffic fatalities in developing countries and how they affect economies. That story when we come back.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you have any suggestions for how governments can fight illegal child labor?
I think the government should put stringent and strict laws so that can govern, tackle like every person that is exercising child labor.
Do something for the youth, especially the youths, like start up some stuff that the youths can engage themselves into. Those that are not going to school, because most of the things happening because these people didn't go to school.
Those laws are there. They don't follow them up. There's nothing that is being done. It should start putting into practice whatever it puts down.
The government should ban those people who employ young people, and then those companies that tend to say they're taking the youth outside to work. Most of the time you find that those people go there and they end up suffering.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday health segment, and today We are talking about deadly traffic accidents. Traffic fatalities are more than just individual tragedies. They have a sting on economic growth in developing countries, according to a new World Bank report. The study is among the first to show that investing in road safety in low- and middle-income countries would raise national incomes. VOA's Steve Baragona reports.
Traffic accidents are a top 10 cause of death worldwide, according to the World Health Organization. 90% happen in the developing world. But the issue does not get much attention, says World Bank transportation expert Dipen Bose.
There is not a lot of political will in many low- and middle-income countries to take definitive actions to reduce road deaths and injuries.
The study Bose co-authored focused on five countries: China, India, Thailand, the Philippines, and Tanzania. It used mathematical models to estimate what each country's economy would gain from safer roads over a 24-year period.
So the results were quite startling.
Thailand would see a 22% boost to national income by cutting traffic deaths in half. The country's high rates of both economic growth and traffic accidents meant it had the most to gain. Tanzania would gain 7%. The other countries fell in between. These kinds of economic gains are something no national government can ignore, Bose said.
It gives kind of the economic story of why it is important to take strong actions on road safety.
The report says enforcing speed limits, helmet and seatbelt laws, and cutting down on drunk driving are low-hanging fruit. But drivers are only partly responsible for traffic deaths, says road safety expert Anna Bray Sharpen at the World Resources Institute.
If the system's not safe, if people don't have the opportunity to cross the road safely or drive in a safe vehicle, then a small error can result in a fatality, and that should not be the case.
Bray Sharpen co-authored a separate report that says city planners and government officials are responsible for building safety into the transportation system. That often does not happen, she says.
So, for example, many cities have applied highway design guidelines even to their city streets, which basically are designed to facilitate maximum traffic flow and speed.
But they are not designed for bikers or pedestrians, she adds.
People tend to take risks to try and cross the road. And that comes back to this issue of whether this is a question of personal responsibility or a co-responsibility between governments and planners and people using the road.
The report offers guidance on how to incorporate safety into road design. It's timely, Bray Sharpen adds, because many developing countries are currently planning major road infrastructure projects.
Basically, there's a window of opportunity now to integrate safety into that planning, which is much more cost-effective than trying to retrofit safe elements of design into the system later on.
And these roads will be around for decades, she added. If they're not built safely, they will be taking a toll for a long time to come. Steve Baragona, VOA News, Washington.
We now turn to Cameroon, where tensions continue to climb in the country's two English-speaking regions following the arrest of as many as 11 separatist leaders earlier this month in neighboring Nigeria. Muki Edwin Kinzeka has this story from the southwestern capital of Boyer.
Panic gripped the residents of several towns in Cameroon's Anglophone southwest Monday as separatist groups vowed to keep up the pressure for the release of their leaders detained in Nigeria. The southwest capital was abuzz with reports that unidentified armed men were attacking schools and had reportedly kidnapped two traders. The confusion spread to Moya, Moyuka, Kumba, and other towns in the southwest. VOA could find no eyewitnesses to any alleged violence. No security officials have confirmed the reports of attacks, but panic ensued nonetheless.
It was a terrible day. Everybody was running to every direction. I first of all locked myself in my shop, but the shouting and running made me to change my mind. I trekked through the bush to my house.
VOA met textile trader Ann Manka early Tuesday at the main market in Boya. The city was quiet, but she and several other traders had decided to keep their shop closed. Boya Mayor Ekema Patrick blames rumors for the panic.
We have been moving around to assure the parents that life has regained its normalcy within the municipality.
At the government bilingual grammar school Moliko in Boya, school teacher Emmanuel Amin said barely 20% of his students had returned to class Tuesday.
Today as we speak, we have 71 students. All our teachers are in place. Maybe we have more students coming.
Southwest Regional Governor Bernard Okalia-Bilai says secessionist groups are trying to manipulate the public.
We should remain vigilant. Parents should continue to protect their children and allow them to go to schools. The children have already suffered last year. It should not happen again this year. Security measures have been put in place to protect the entire population and all the activities.
The Anglophone crisis began in November 2016 when teachers and lawyers in Cameroon's two English-speaking regions went on strike. The strike devolved into violent unrest and stalemate, shuttering schools for a year. Meanwhile, separatist groups emerged calling for the two Anglophone regions to break away. In October, the secessionist groups declared a new state they call Ambazonia. The declaration sparked deadly unrest, and there have since been several clashes in Cameroon between suspected separatists and the military. The so-called president of Ambazonia and at least eight other people were arrested January 5 in Nigeria. The separatists have declared a curfew 3 days a week for residents of the southwest and northwest until their leaders are freed. In a news release emailed to news agencies Tuesday, a group identifying itself as the interim government of Ambazonia said Nigerian authorities are keeping 11 of their leaders detained incommunicado without access to lawyers or relatives. Amnesty International has expressed concern the detainees could face torture and unfair trials if extradited from Nigeria. The government of Cameroon has declined to comment on the arrest. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Boya, southwestern Cameroon.
In Uganda, government officials are excited over the idea of creating its own social media platform. But social media users and government critics see this as a potential effort to control freedom of expression. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
Facebook and Twitter should brace themselves for competition from Uganda. With no name yet or date on when the new services will be operational, the Uganda Communications Commission is planning to launch its own social media platforms. Commission Director Godfrey Mutabazi says Uganda has many young people who have come up with innovations and applications that can be deployed to serve the population.
There is open information for everything. So we have got over almost 70% penetration. We are moving to digital era, data communication. We hope that by the end of this year, 20-25%, maybe up 30% of Ugandans will be on data communication. So we shall access the information education-wise, research, name it, will be available.
Nicholas Opio, Executive Director of Chapter 4 Uganda, a local civil liberties organization, says Uganda is not seeking to develop its own social media space because it appreciates the innovative power of social media. He fears a darker purpose.
One, I don't believe they can do it, but if they want to do it, it is not for the best of intentions. Recent studies have shown that the government of Uganda is now involved in active filtering of particular information, namely information about corruption, information about same-sex relations, critical of government policies on the first family. That's what they're trying to do, because the biggest threat to this government now is an informed citizenry.
In 2016, the Ugandan government shut down social media twice, on election day and during President Yoweri Museveni's swearing-in ceremony. For social media users like Jackie Kemgisa, a move by the government regulator to set up its own social media is cause to worry.
As a person who uses social media and whose source of employment, everything that I do is online, it was a horrible idea. At first I thought it was a joke. So counting on the sad part of it that they don't have the money And if they do, well, then Ugandans will have to re-strategize, go back to the drawing board and see how we can still fight for our freedoms.
Critics say a social media platform controlled by the government will put Uganda in the same league as countries such as Iran, China and North Korea. But the Uganda Communications Commission has described those who see this innovation as eroding freedom of speech as patronizing. The government agency insists they just want to keep hate speech out of Ugandan social media and says the new platforms are going to be positive. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. The South Sudan peace agreement signed just last month may collapse as the warring parties continue to trade accusations of violations. Kosti Manibe, the spokesman of a faction of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, charges that South Sudan First Vice President Taban Dengai has been touring Jonglei and the Upper Nile region with a large contingency of well-armed soldiers, which he calls a violation of the cessation of hostilities agreement signed in Addis Ababa. Kosti says it's a clear violation whether the First Vice President knows it or not. JMEC has not reported such violations to date, but Kosti says people are talking about it. He says Taban Dengai has been seen by many groups throughout the country in those areas. Classes at Harare Institute of Technology are set to begin early next month, but some South Sudanese students there on government scholarship say they don't know if they can continue their studies. That's because the Juba government has not paid their tuition money again. 22-year-old Ganiko Michael Bangoya, third-year student studying electronic commerce in Zimbabwe, says it's difficult to concentrate on exams when you're under that kind of pressure. Bangoya is one of 26 South Sudanese students in Harare whose scholarships are supposed to be paid by the government. He said he's heard rumors that the government's planning to recall the students, aside from those who are preparing to graduate in September. We don't know what will happen. Either we will be taken back, but we are here and we are struggling, he said. The students say the government has not paid hundreds of thousands of dollars in unpaid tuition. And finally, deadly traffic accidents are more than just individual tragedies. They hurt economic growth in developing countries, according to a new World Bank report. Studies among the first to show that investing in road safety in low- and middle-income countries would raise national incomes. Traffic accidents are a top 10 cause of death worldwide. 90% happen in the developing world. World Bank transportation expert Dipen Bose says there is not a lot of attention paid to the problem in low- and middle-income countries. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song We Want Peace by South Sudanese superstar Emmanuel Jal.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm looking for some people who's looking for peace. Maybe together we could make the war cease. Now we can send mankind to the moon, and we can reach to the bottom of the sea. That's why it really kind of baffles me that we cannot end wars and bring peace, and we cannot change the way people act, and we cannot change the way people think. So if we sit back, chill out and relax, civilization will soon be extinct. That's why I am. I'm calling on. This common evil. I wish the world was a little bit better. Time to start looking at the man in the mirror. Fear is the devil's policeman. Fear make good genocide with Hitler so he can. Feel a war of genocide and love was weakened. Lighten up the land cause nobody was speaking. That's why I am. I'm calling on the whole world.
We've been listening to South Sudanese superstar Emmanuel Jal with the song We Want Peace. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We would like to know what you think about this show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
People living and die for.